David, thank you very much. The work of the Energy Transitions Commission, which I chair, is global. We are involved as much on how does China decarbonize, how does India decarbonize, as how does Europe or the UK decarbonize. But obviously, I've also been deeply involved in the UK in the past as chair of the Climate Change Committee. And we've got this report from Chris, came out a few months ago, this net zero report, which is a very clear point of view of what the UK needs to get to net zero. So I thought what it might be useful for me to do is make some observations about the big trends and big priorities we see at global level, but then relate them to what is in Chris's report specifically for the UK. We've just produced a Energy Transition Commission report on finance to support the transition to net zero across the world. The headline figure is that investments of about 1 trillion per annum in all sorts of different categories of green technology have to rise to about 3.5 trillion by 2030, be maintained at that level before declining, beginning their decline in the 2040s and 50s. But there's one interesting point about that 3.5 trillion when you look at it by sector, is that though, of course, it is important to build battery factories and electrolyzers and new cement kilns, the absolutely dominating figure within that 3.5 trillion, 2.4 trillion of it on average per annum, 70%, is the power system. And that 70 splits between 40, which is power generation, and 30, which is grids, transmission and distribution. And I think sometimes we sort of know that, but we lose sight of it, the absolute centrality of building a much bigger and entirely zero carbon electricity system is at the absolute core of all paths to net zero. Around the world, in some countries, we see the need for dramatic growth in the electricity system of a local environment. In Indonesia, where I've been recently, or in India, we're talking about electricity systems which by 2050 or 60 will be have to be 5, 6, or even 8 times bigger than they are today. Across the whole world, our scenarios suggest global electricity production and consumption going from about 27,000 terawatt hours today to maybe 90,000 or more by 2050. And what's interesting is that even in rich developed countries, which have had electricity for a century and more, we will see very significant required growth of the electricity system. In the UK, we would think about an increase from 300 terawatt hours of consumption today to 600, 700, or potentially more by 2050. Now, the good news is I think we know the core of the UK electricity system of the future. I think it will have a role of nuclear as a base load, perhaps providing 20%. I was interested by Chris's focus on solar, not in everybody's scenarios, that 70 gigawatts, but I think what everybody agrees is that the absolute core of the future system is offshore wind, because remember, offshore wind, once you put it in place, will approximately give you 5,000, even 6,000 hours of production per year on average. Solar, you'll be lucky to get 2,000 or 1,500 hours in the UK. You want a balance, but offshore will be the absolute core of it. So how are we doing on offshore? Well, we have a clear target of having 50 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030, and that could produce as much as 250 terawatt hours. And I think we will see that going to 70 by 2040, maybe 100 by 2050. One of the crucial points to make is that targets matter. It's very important that we establish at least 10 years out those government targets for how big a thing like offshore wind would be, because it is behind that that businesses can develop supply chains with the certainty of the size of the market. We also need, and I think Chris's report sets this out, a clarity on the role of nuclear. We are certainly at the ETC not against new nuclear. At the moment, I think it looks more expensive than offshore wind significantly, but I have it there as a hedge. It's always good to have a diversity within your system of electricity, but probably not more than 20% of our future electricity. The key is certain strategy. The key is also removing various barriers that can get in the way of the speed at which we operate. Chris has talked about the necessity of having our planning system place a high priority on a net zero transition. And one of the ways that that needs to be reflected is in the planning and permitting system. That doesn't mean tearing up required environmental standards, but it does mean having systems which are smarter, which mean that we can reduce the time to develop, for instance, an offshore wind farm from 11 years, as it often is at the moment, from initial idea and taking the seabed lease through to operation. We think we can get that down from 11 years to 4, and we will need to do that. But some of the most important challenges in electricity systems across the world and in the UK are not actually in the generation itself. In a sense, we know the cheapest way to produce electricity in most parts of the world, and it's almost always renewables. That's the cheapest way to produce a kilowatt hour of electricity. Some of the biggest challenges are now in grids and in balancing the system. In grids, there's a recent report out by Bloomberg New Energy Finance, which suggests that 1 terawatt hour, 1,000 gigawatt hours of renewable capacity is waiting in queues to get grid connected in the Europe and the US together. And we have those problems in the UK as well. And the challenge is that we're just not building grids fast enough to deal with the generation and the new sources of demand, such as heat pumps or electric vehicle chargers that we need. And part of the challenge there, and Chris's report focuses on it, is that we have not defined for Ofgem that one of their most important objectives must be to regulate the grids, both distribution and transmission, in a way which supports the transition to net zero. We must allow grids to invest ahead of demand rather than responding to demand when it's immediately facing us. The other big challenge that is faced across the world, it's generic in general terms, but differs in specifics, is how to balance supply and demand of electricity across the days, weeks, and months. What to do when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. In some places where we're working, the answer will be very heavily related to batteries. In places like Indonesia or India, where the vast majority of the electricity capacity renewable will come from solar rather than wind, and where the key balancing challenge is diurnal rather than seasonal, day to night, batteries will play a very major role in, as it were, enabling the air conditioners to keep running after the sun has gone down and the solar PV has stopped producing. But in the UK, we face a very different problem. It is essentially about the variability of wind. I don't know if many of you out there do what I do, which is have an app on my phone, which tells me what is going on with the generation mix of the UK electricity, minute by minute you can get it. And it's interesting how dramatically it changes. Only yesterday, we were generating at about 250 grams per kilowatt hour. Today, we're down at 140 grams per kilowatt hour. And that's because the wind is blowing stronger. Yesterday, the wind was only producing, I think in the middle of the day when I looked at it, about 15% of our electricity, and gas was running at over 50%. Right now, wind is running over 40% and gas is below 30%. And as we develop more and more wind offshore and onshore and solar, what we will end up with is systems where on average through the year, renewables will be providing, I think, 70% of all our electricity, but we will have a major challenge in what the Germans call a Dunkelflaute, or we call the doldrums, those 2 or 3 week periods where wind can go down seriously and continuously in the North Sea with a blocking anticyclone over Northwest Europe, just at the time when we have cold weather and therefore the electricity use goes up. You could see that this year between December and January. December, We had a lot of cold, dry, windless weather. Our system was producing very little wind. And then in January, we had an absolute bonanza of wind, many days, even already, of over 50% wind. We have got to have a serious national strategic plan of how we are going to deal with that particular challenge, which is our challenge, very different from the challenges, for instance, in tropical latitude countries. That challenge will, I think, require a large bank of gas turbines to continue to exist. I think it is unclear whether we will run those gas turbines burning hydrogen, or whether we will run them continuing to burn methane gas and then doing carbon capture and storage. But whichever one we end up with, we will need storage capacity, either for CO2 or for hydrogen, so that we know that one of our key strategic priorities in the UK is to get serious about understanding our geological storage capabilities, the ability to repurpose our gas reservoirs, the potential for our salt caverns, to use them in some combination, either for storage of CO2 while continuing to use methane, or building, making hydrogen when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, and then burning it in gas turbines. Either way, we are going to have a significant need to store molecules of gas, and we need a clear vision of how we're going to do it and support for the businesses which are developing ideas and strategies and investments on either of those possibilities. So the power system is absolutely fundamental. In our finance report, the second most important element of finance required out of that 3.5 trillion was buildings. In addition to 2.4 trillion per annum for the power system, about 500 billion for buildings. Buildings means a different thing in different parts of the world. In the developing world, it fundamentally means building houses and cities right first time, insulated well, with good HVAC, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems, which have high levels of performance, high coefficients of performance in the air conditioners, etc. It's a getting it right first time strategy in the wave of urbanization, which is occurring across much of the developing world. In our country, it's fundamentally primarily a retrofit challenge, but it is a big one. And it's therefore not surprising to me that when I looked at Chris's objectives, the back of his executive summary, and there are, I think, 25 of them, the first three were all about buildings. We have 28 million households in the UK, 23 million of them have gas boilers, and they have all got to make a decision on what they're going to do about that. And actually, that's why, although we sometimes talk about the hard to abate sectors of the economy being shipping or aviation or steel or cement, I've increasingly come to the belief that the hard to abate sectors is residential homes. Because in the steel sector of the world, I could get together in one room 1,000 top managers of the 50 top steel companies. And if they all agreed to do something, it would happen. That is a much easier management implementation challenge than getting 25, 28 million households to make decisions. In order to drive that, and Chris has set it out, we are going to need a much more forceful and strategic approach to this. Chris talked about getting 600,000 heat pumps in place by 2028. But if we go down the electric route, and I think we probably will, we will have to be installing heat pumps about 1 million per annum for the next 15 years to end up with a decarbonized residential heat system. That will require a much more strategic approach to finance. And I think Chris's focus on the role of KfW in Germany is a major example that the UK Infrastructure Bank should be looking at as to whether they should be a very major funder of cheap rate loans to people to do the insulation and the heat pump installation in order to get their homes get to net zero. But it will also require a very strategic approach to skills development. The Climate Change Committee, in one of its recent reports, highlighted that there's a huge job opportunity in the plumbers and the electricians and the people who install the the insulation needed for us to create a zero carbon housing stock, about 200,000 extra jobs. But that 200,000 extra jobs isn't going to magically appear immediately. I can tell you, I have recently had a heat pump installed at my country cottage in Hampshire, and I was waiting 18 months for the only local supplier, a sort of one or two man band, to put me to the front of the queue so that I could last get it done. If you go out and try to get a heat pump at the moment, you will find you are in a seller's, not buyer's market. And we have a huge effort to be done to create the businesses and the skills and the people required to respond to the amount of public money and lending which we will need to drive the decarbonisation of residential heat. In many other sectors of the economy, in the industrial sector, the commercial sector, particularly when we're not in the hardest sectors like steel or cement, I think a lot will happen as long as we have clear carbon prices which set an environment which changes people's behavior. And in a sense, we will have to use decentralized policy levers in those environments. But as Chris's report sets out, in order to make sure that carbon prices are not to the disadvantage of our high carbon intensive sectors, such as steel, we have also got to put in place very quickly a coherent border carbon adjustment mechanism, which bluntly should mirror as much as possible the border carbon adjustment mechanism being put in place by the EU. You will not find a single operator of steel companies around Europe, and most of the companies which operate in the UK also are or will want to be able to operate in Europe, who wants anything other than a somewhat standardized system for their businesses in the rest of Europe and in the UK. And we've simply got to find an intelligent way forward. So those are some thoughts on the sectors where we are making some progress, where we need to make more progress, and what it looks like globally and what it looks like at the UK level. Just one final point, one sector where I am probably most worried at the global level and probably also most worried at the UK as well. I am actually convinced at the global level that if we focus on the energy, building, industry and transport sectors of the economy, we will get to something pretty close to a net zero global economy by 2060, 2050 in the developed world, 2060 in most of the developing, because the technologies are going to take us there. I think the path to net zero could be too slow, could be too, as it were, convex up than we want. And frankly, we wasted 15 years after we really understood the challenges after the Climate Change Act of 2006, the Stern Report, the Copenhagen climate conference failure. We wasted a lot of time globally, and we are behind. So I wish we could progress the EBIT decarbonisation faster. But in energy, building, industry and transport, we will inevitably get there. But at the moment, I really know no way, I have no certainty that we are going to put a stop to the deforestation of the Amazon, which is above all driven by one thing, meat consumption, and above all, red meat consumption. I don't know how the world can continue to grow meat consumption and preserve those rainforests. So when I switch from the EBIT sectors to agriculture, food, and land use at the global level, that's where I get about a bit gloomy. And I think our way forward is not clear. Or our way forward requires either changes in behavior, eating less meat, or new technologies, synthetic meats, which I'm not absolutely sure we'll be able to deliver in the way that we can on energy, building and transport. And when I think about it in the UK, I also see an absence of real clarity as to what our strategy is for agriculture. The Climate Change Committee in its reports has talked about achieving at least a significant reduction in red meat consumption. But that is not agreed by everybody and strongly opposed by some others. You may be able to find solutions to that with new forms of feed which produce less methane, but if we're going to develop that, we better develop those fast. And the CCC also reports talks about a very major reforestation program to greatly increase our woodland cover in England in particular, but also Scotland, which has a massively lower woodland cover than, for instance, France or Germany. But I see no clear strategy for us achieving that. So the one thing I would highlight, along with residential heating, which I think is one of the missing bits of our strategy in the UK, is what really is our strategy on agriculture, food, and land use. Thank you.